Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus and I welcome you to Mages, Sages, and Seers. Tonight we're honored to have Come West on Come West Speaks. But first, let me play a song, If You Can Dream, by Virginia Ginger Ackley.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be bound by love and yet be free, but only if you can dream. When love and trust are deep and fair, there is nothing your heart won't dare, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. Dream till it's real.
That was If You Can Dream by Ginger Ackley, and now we return to Come West Speaks, and without further ado, we proceed to Come West. Greetings, Setna. How are you, sir?
The cosmos was strange, but I am here. The vehicle, our vehicle called Blog Talk Radio, literally hung up on me, and I apologize to our listeners. It was a most strange interlude of weirdness.
That has been happening a lot lately.
Well, I want to address something.
Sure.
3 days ago, 2 days ago, was the pagan holiday Samhain. And what that is a celebration of those who have passed on before. So I want to take a moment of silence to reflect our friends and family members and people that recently have passed away and think about them in their lives and to celebrate them for just a moment, and we'll move on from there. But this is important because this is the season where the veil is thin and that line between life and death is much, much more accessible. So for a moment, let's just say thank you to the universe for those we've known and passed on. Okay. Everyone take a deep breath and let's come back to where we are right now. I want to welcome you all and say thank you to Hercules, who is without a doubt the most incredible being I know on this and many other planes.
I'm honored by your words. Thank you.
I know many people of great power, many. And it's not only power that you have, it's grace. There are very few people in this world anymore who understand the meaning of the word grace or who embody it, and you do. You are noble and you are gracious.
Thank you for your kind words, and I think very highly of you as well. You're very special.
We are talking tonight about symbology and symbols. The ancient Egyptian language, the entire language, is made up of symbols. But I also want to talk about ones that we know very well. From the beginning, from the primeval matter of primeval matter, there are two. The first one is eternity. It's Shen, S-H-E-N in English. Shen is a circle with a horizontal line drawn beneath it. Mouth is not cooperating. A circle with a line, a horizontal line below it. Very simple. And it means that you will go on forever. Shen. And it's very simple. It's probably the first symbol the ancient Egyptians drew in the sand, probably. The second one is simple and very similar. And that is Ankh. And everyone in this culture, in this world, knows what an Ankh looks like. You have a loop, usually like a reverse teardrop, not a circle, and a cross below it, a T, a line in horizontal, and in the middle, a line that is vertical. I can just imagine ancient people with a stick or their finger drawing the symbol in the sand. Now, it's an interesting thing. One of the great Greek historians, Herodotus, asked someone in Egypt how they came across this symbol. And if you look down at your feet, he said, the Ankh is a sandal strap. And the poor in Egypt maybe got one set of sandals as they grew up. And when the sandal strap broke, your life was over, they said. It's done. But it is a symbol. It's a sandal strap. Most people don't know that. They don't know where that came from. But it is a very powerful amulet. If you look at all the paintings, every painting in a tomb, a god or a goddess, is carrying an Ankh and holding it to the mouth of the king or queen or administrator or whoever it is, their tomb belongs to them. And it's giving them the breath of eternal life. But it's also, I wear an Ankh every day. Everyone who knows me knows that. And what it's also saying is I'm sending positive life force energy to whomever sees it. And it's a greeting. And it's part of the three-part greeting that every Egyptian says, hello and goodbye. Like Hawaii, they say hello, aloha, can be hello or goodbye.
In Greece, it's yasu. That can mean hello and goodbye. It literally means to your health. But it can be used as a hello, as a goodbye, as a salute during drinking.
Cool. It's exactly the same as the Egyptian three-part greeting, which is Ankh, life, Uja, which is a very interesting loop, and Seneb, which means prosperity. So when they meet you, they will say Ankh, Uja, Seneb, life, health, and prosperity. And when they leave you, we will say it. And I always, if you've known me a while, folks, you know that I always say that.
Yes.
Ankh Uja Seneb, hello and goodbye. It's a good way to leave someone or to greet someone. Now, those are very simple symbols. Egyptian hieroglyph is more complicated, but not really. If you look at any, I'm looking right now at a papyrus that someone brought me recently. If you look at the papyri, you will see not only written words, phrases, in their alphabet, but you'll also see this, what's going on. If you look at literally, I'm looking at a cat in the reeds. I have a new cat, as people know.
Yes.
I won't bring him up right now, although he is sitting on my lap. The cat in the reed shows a Egyptian hunter, and he's in a little tiny boat, and he's standing up, and he has a bow and arrow and a spear, and he is being assisted by an orange cat that is in the reeds and frightening ducks so that the Egyptian can then shoot the arrow or spear the ducks, and then the cat, like a dog in other countries, would go retrieve it. Now, I know that takes a while to do because cats have their own mind, as you know. They're very definite animals. They have their own thought on things. So I don't know how many of those ducks actually got into the boat.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure many of them, the cat was like, you know what? I helped you. This is my duck. I can see that happening.
Me too.
I am very much, I'm a cat person, so I know that that's probably true. But what the point is, instead of writing all that, they use the pictures to produce the praise, to produce the language. They didn't have it. There was no verbiage. It was literal. The cat in the reeds and the hunter. And that was the story right there. Very easy, don't you think? If you look at any of the tomb paintings I'm looking, I have many, many tapestries in this room that I live in. And I have one that I'm looking at of the pharaoh Seti. And he is between Ra, Heru, and Osiris. And the reason that he's standing between Horus and Osiris is that Horus is life, and Osiris, his father, is afterlife. And above them, they have the goddess Nehabit, who is a gigantic vulture. And she's standing with a standard in her claws, and she's showing that she will protect Egypt even after the pharaoh has passed on. And, you almost don't have to read. There are hieroglyphs between them also, but you almost don't have to read them to get the idea. I have the cartouche of the pharaoh Seti, and I have the two symbols for the god and the gods of Horus and the god Osiris. Osiris is a very simple hieroglyph. He has his wife Isis as a steps. There is an eye above it. And there is also a man dressed as it is. And they show his backbone. It's called the Jed pillar, which is literally what it looks like a backbone. You have the discs, and then there's a plate. And in his case, is the crown, the Atep crown, the white crown, is on top of it. But it doesn't say Osiris in literal words. It says his name in the hieroglyph. It says, and if you were going to write it, you'd write his name Asar, A-S-A-R. And that's simple. Well, I've been studying hieroglyphs since I was 8 years old, and I'm 65, so it's simple for me now. But A, after all these years, I think in hieroglyph. It's very interesting. So A is a falcon. S, there are two ways to do S. S can be a loop, like a piece of papyrus that's a loop, or you can do it in later dynasties where it is the bar that would bolt a door. You have the two handles and the door bolt. So that's one long line, horizontal line, and two short vertical lines that are holding it. So it's like a long H in a way. Then you have another falcon for A. And then you have R. And R in Egypt is represented by a mouth. I don't understand where that came from. But so A-S-A-R, falcon, door bolt, falcon, mouth, and it says Asar. The word Osiris, as you know, is a Ptolemaic Greek version of Asar.
Yes.
I guess, we don't know. There were so many different ways of doing the vowels that A could have been an O or an I. So, but I's and E's and Y's are usually made by a sideways leaf, palm leaf, usually facing left, and it's a line, a curved line, and you have the front, the pieces of the front that are neatly trimmed. But vowels were not something they really used. And Egyptologists to this day write things, and later another Egyptologist will come by and go, you've spelled that wrong. And, you know, if you think about it, if you're in a tomb and you're spelling something wrong, you'd have to chisel the whole thing off. So it's a problem. I was looking at a tattoo show a couple of days ago, and the girl wanted to have on her side, no regrets. And the tattoo artist was very high, apparently, according to her. And he wrote, no regrets.
No
regrets. You've seen that one too, huh?
I haven't seen that one, but I've seen other tattoo atrocities.
Yeah, there's a show called Bad Ink that I've been watching lately. But it's like the same thing. If hieroglyphs are done wrong, you know, you can't do a cover-up. You got to chisel it off. It's very difficult. So that's probably why I don't have any ink on me. Plus, I don't know. I'm a makeup artist, as everybody knows, and I like things that you can do over. You can do temporarily. Egyptians, on the other hand, what they wrote on the tomb walls and in the pyramids and in the temples have lasted since thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So it's a good thing the spelling is done right. But on that note, if you go into the tomb, and I'm fortunate to say that I have been in the tomb of Tutankhamun, that was made very hastily. And you'll see further into the tomb straight lines and hieroglyphics that are written rather than the black ink or tempera paint that they usually use and raised up, you'll find red drawings where the scribe who was writing things out for the artisan later to paint over didn't finish. And you can see that, you know, that's there. It's like, okay, we began this phrase, but we didn't have time because it was time for the ritual to happen. And so it's further back in the tomb. And I guess the Egyptians felt, okay, this is the main entrance. This is that beautiful, beautiful funerary tomb and funerary mortuary room. And I guess they figured those two were enough. And so the last couple were never finished. It was very hastily buried. So the hieroglyphs, they're not wrong. They're just not finished. And I'm wondering, is that going to affect him immortally? What if the soul is wandering in there and goes, hey, they didn't finish this. after 4,000 years, who do you complain to? You know? But I'm looking also again at this wall, this tomb painting of Seti and Horus and Osiris. All of them are carrying the crooked flail. Now, everybody knows about Egypt knows that the pharaoh has two, I'll call them scepters. The crook, which is a shepherd's crook, which is for mercy and guardianship. The flail is punishment. It's sternness. So the pharaoh rules both ways with hopefully mercy and kindness, but also he can be harsh. And that's what those two symbols are, the whip and the flail or the cane, the shepherd's crook. I don't think very many people explain that. And it can be held incorrectly also, and it will change the meaning as well. Do you have any questions so far, Hercules?
No, but you're doing great in explaining these things.
Well, it's important. These are symbols that have been around for thousands of years. People look at them, they're like, okay, that's nice, and then they don't understand them. A very important one that a lot of other people I always wear every day also is a scarab. It's a dung beetle. Unlike the movie The Mummy, they don't eat people, they don't eat flesh.
I always thought that was funny, the movie with Brandon Fraser.
Yes.
And it's a very, you know, it's a very cool kind of now tacky classic. But the scarabs, the dung beetle, in ancient times, someone observed that the beetle is carrying this ball of camel dung or whomever dung around. And after a while, he stops the scarab. It's usually a male scarab. And the ball cracks open and hundreds of baby scarabs come out. And so they believe that the scarab is immortal, eternal life. They didn't know that the scarabs, you know, had planted seeds in there. But we are talking about first dynasty. And now we know from our studies that pre-dynastic times go back almost 10,000 years. So the scarab is also one of the oldest symbols. Originally, it's just drawn as an oval with five loops on top and six legs, because it's a beetle, it has six legs. And sometimes when it's immortal, the god Khepra, which is the god of immortality in Egypt, the bestower of immortality. Osiris, as you know, is the lord of the permission to have immortality. They're very complicated. They have, it's very much like a government, their eternity, because you have all kinds of government officials. You've got Anubis, you've got Horus, like Tehute, Osiris, Lady Nephthys, and the goddess of, who I'm going to get to soon, Balant, who's Maat, who, you know, tips the scales either for or against you. But the scarab represents the eternal life force that everyone has. And there's also something else that's very interesting. Later on in later dynasties, when they started to realize, you know, if I had a really bad person, they'd do something to protect themselves. So, because the scarab covers the heart. And it protects the heart. But back in those days, also, the scarab was also, how do I say this nicely, a liar.
Okay.
The scarab would not allow the heart to tell the truth. It was kind of a, you know, shush there. I'll answer for you. Because they realized, let's face it, if you were a corrupt official, or you were sleeping with your neighbor's harem, you know, or... You know, you've killed off another official, which happened a great deal. And you go into the next world. Well, there's the scales of justice. And your heart is put on one side, and the feather of truth, which we'll get to also, is on the other. And if your heart is not light, and your heart sinks because of all the guilt and all the bad things, and the feather gets higher, the god Thoth, who is the god of knowledge and wisdom, but he's also a recorder of what goes on in the immortality, we'll take that heart off, throw it to a creature called Amit. Amit is a combination thing. It's a monster, I would call it. It has the head of a crocodile, the front end of a lion, and the back end of a hippopotamus. This thing is ugly, mean, and if it eats your heart out, literally, you cease to exist in the universe. Your energy has been dispersed, and you will no longer be a corporate or physical or spiritual being. Your energy will be used some other way. But you're not,
wow.
You cease to exist. It's pretty heavy.
Yes, it is.
Some of the priests of Osiris at the Temple of Abydos originally said, this is terrible, you know? What if, you know, and because let's face it, I'm going to be honest, some of the priesthood was a little corrupt. And by the time you get to the 18th and 19th dynasty, things were not so cool. They created a scarab. Many of them were in beautiful green granite, or they were obsidian, or they were made of faience, which, of course, is a clay that's been fired. Beautiful jewels, cornelian. The one I'm wearing right now is made of blue lapis lazuli, because it's got very strong healing powers. But the scarab, there's a whole thing. The scarab gives a speech. My heart, my mother, my heart. And it starts talking about the goodness of the person. So the heart scarab, even if you're a terrible being, the heart scarab would protect them so that they could pass into the next life. I don't know, in my energy field, I think that even if you are a terrible person, I don't think that the amulet would not allow higher deities to see through that. How do you feel about that, Hercules?
Well, the tales of the animal powers, and I guess insects would be animal powers, always include an animal power that's a trickster, one that doesn't encourage the telling of truth, but uses trickery or uses cunning to solve a situation. So I have no doubt that in the Egyptian, the scarab served much the same purpose.
It's exactly the case. The scarab was basically lying, you know, deceiving the deities so that the person could pass into infinity. But my point is that I think divine beings are wiser than that. And that although the person has the scarab on its heart, I still think that the deities would say, now look here, you killed 7,500 people here. You know, or you slept with your neighbor's wife, or you've stolen half of the county's cows. We can't let you pass. I believe that. I really do. I think that, you know, the merits, the heart does speak anyway. But the scarab was like a gag to hide the heart's sins. It's false. But it was done not from the beginning of ancient history, but from about, I would say, the fourth dynasty. You'll find them as the pyramids were built. And we didn't find scarabs in the early tombs or the early, where it was just skeletons and such before mummification. But you did find them as you went on and as the Egyptian civilization developed and people became more sophisticated and started thinking about things like eternity.
Now, there was a tale, I forget who reported the tale, but it's part of the Hercules mythos. And in one of the tales where he goes to Egypt, it was during his quest for the golden apples of the Hesperides, he's captured by Busiris, who is supposed to be an Egyptian king who wanted to sacrifice him because it was their custom to sacrifice all strangers. And even in antiquity, this was very strange because it didn't jibe with what people knew about Egyptian hospitality laws and attitudes towards travelers and visitors. But it is something that persisted and it made it into the literature. So I'm wondering if there was some tales of Osiris that we don't have anymore that might have explained this legend.
It's very possible because Osiris was a very, very kind and very noble and fair ruler. It was his brother, Set, who, you know, threw a temper tantrum and cut him into 14 pieces because his civilization, his country, which was Libya, wasn't doing very well. They were not trading with other nations. They were not, the cattle were dying. They were on a cataract of the Nile where it wasn't doing very well. So he got jealous. I don't want to get into that right now. It's very complicated. But I do think maybe that, and it's Busiris you're talking about, right?
Yeah, Busiris, they called him. Busiris.
Busiris. Okay, yeah, but that's, the pharaoh would have been Busiris. I know who you're talking about.
Okay.
And he was actually a very cruel pharaoh. He was known, he had, one of his wives was at one time a priestess of Ishtar. And the people, that was Assyria and Babylon. And those people were known to throw prisoners into a fiery furnace. It's even in the Bible where they had people going to be destroyed and thrown into the fiery furnace. So it's possible that he had a wife that was not a very good influence on him. And I think that's where that tale of Hercules comes through, that he probably was traveling in that period. Busiris is 11th or 12th dynasty, I think, and he was a very cruel ruler. Eventually, when his son or came into power, he was executed
Ooh.
For his evil. So this sound just smacks of this. So
yeah,
let's get on a better one.
Okay.
No,
sorry about that.
I'm sorry. How does the tale with Hercules end?
Well, Hercules defeated him. He broke his chains and he defeated him and he ended this cruel custom, according to the stories.
Well, knowing Hercules as well as I know Hercules, he will always fight against injustice. And always, in many of the old tales, he destroyed many, many, many negative kings and queens and put someone better in their place. And so it may have very strong basis. In fact, I think that all legends do have a base, a truth base in them that come from somewhere. And then, you know, of course, like all peoples, we embellish everything, and it gets more out of crazy. The other thing I want to talk about when we get back to things now, in every painting, in every sculpture, in every wall art, you're going to see the gods or goddesses wearing on their head a disc. And the disc is the sun. But it's also, like in the Christian drawings, very much like an aura, a halo. Although the Egyptians draw it on top of the head, it could be behind as well, as though it were a halo of power and a symbol of the spirits or god or goddesses energy and powers. And so that was kind of a cool thing. And you'll see that I'm looking in around my room, and you'll see that over many, many goddesses and many gods, just to show I have this energy. I am divine. I am above the mortal realm.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that they've always used. And it went as far as from the first dynasty all the way back, all the way up to the Ptolemaic dynasty and into the Roman period. They always did this circle thing above, usually goddesses, but the god Thoth, the god of knowledge, also often wears that. And Horus and Ra, of course, too, on their head. And around that circle, around that disc, is usually a symbol of knowledge and power and protection, and that is the uraeus, that's the cobra.
Mm-hmm.
In Egypt, the cobra was sacred, like many other sacred animals, but the cobra was royalty, protection, knowledge, and also a defender, a warrior against that which would interfere with your life. So I myself always, and you know this, Hercules, always wear on my right hand, on my ring finger, a coiled cobra, which is my uraeus. I've always worn that. This particular silver ring that I wear, I've had since I was about, 14 years old. And it very seldom comes off my hand. But I feel protected because of it. I always have. Some bad things have happened in my life, but not things that I couldn't get out of. You know, that there wasn't, obviously I'm not dead, I'm here. And I do feel that I was protected. And also on that note, we want to go to Wedjet and Uchat. That is the Eye of Horus and the Eye of Ra. The Eye of Horus is the left side. It's usually accompanied by the cobra and by the vulture. So you have the goddess Urea, the cobra, and that would be in the front toward the nose, if it were on the nose. And if you're on the left side, you're going to have Nahabit, who is the great vulture goddess. These are the keepers of Upper and Lower Egypt, the red crown and the white crown. The cobra wears the red crown, and the vulture wears the white crown. Sometimes also drawn blue, but usually, as in Osiris and many other gods, it's a white crown representing Upper and Lower Egypt. But those two goddesses have protected every pharaoh and every queen. You'll find them, every single one of them,
have those. If you look at the mummy case of Tutankhamun, you have a gigantic wrap around the middle section from his shoulders to about, I guess, the ribs. And that is Nahadi, the cobra, the vulture goddess. She's wrapped around him with her wings, and she's protecting him. On his head, on the Nemesis, which is his crown, he has the vulture and the cobra again on his brow. It's interesting. They have the cobra, the vulture head, and you have the cobra, the whole cobra, on his head. I wonder where the rest of the vulture is. You know, in a queen, she's wearing the vulture on her head. It's a beautiful headdress. It's one of my favorite Egyptian headdresses, where the wings go across her shoulders, and the tail is literally on the back of her head. And her head rests, the vulture's head rests, right next to a coiled cobra on many, many queens. It's a very beautiful piece. But
yes,
these symbols... Go ahead, Hercules.
No, go ahead. No, yeah, I was agreeing with you. Yes, they are. They're very beautiful pieces.
I'm addicted to Egyptian jewelry. I have a great deal of it. I use those pieces not for ornamentation so much as I understand the symbology and the energy behind them. And that's why I wear them. And my pieces are blessed at every ritual. Right now, I do have an Eye of Horus on. I'm wearing an Ankh. I have a scarab. And I have, because I'm pagan, I wear a pentacle behind them all. And I also have a piece of black tourmaline, which removes negativity. They didn't use that as much as they used black obsidian. I guess it was more readily available. The stones are similar. Now, around everybody's name, however you wrote the name, is a rope. And the rope is completely around the name. And there's usually a stand or a piece that ties it together in the center. And that's called a cartouche. And that's a French word, probably coined by Champollion, the original interpreter or decipherer of the Egyptian hieroglyphs in the time of Napoleon. The cartouche wrap represents a deep, a magical protection around that name, and by that way it protects the person whose name it is. And it's got all kinds of spells and powers on it. And I'm looking around again my room, and I'm seeing many pharaohs' names and gods and goddesses' names, and they're all enwrapped in this beautiful cartouche. If you go to Egypt now, and you go into Cairo, usually, you'll find many, many stores that will put your name in a cartouche. You have to be careful. Just like bad tattoos, you can get bad cartouches.
Really?
I had a customer whose name was Annalie, and she got it, and she was in the little Egyptian jewelry store, and the guy put the cartouche in, and I read it. And she's very mad. It said analyze rather than Anna Lee.
Ah, okay.
And she lived in Connecticut. And that's a hell of a trip back to Cairo.
Yes, that is quite a trip.
And it was like, you know, I think $125 in American money. And it was gold. But, you know, see, I told her, and I said, don't tell anybody. But yeah, it said analyze. I think he just misunderstood what she said.
Or it could be a way of they're sticking up the middle finger to tourists or people who don't understand their culture. I know that in Chinatown in New York, when I was there, a lot of people complained that they go to Chinatown to get tattoos because they were into martial arts or something. And they thought a tattoo said one thing and actually said something not very nice on it.
I just saw that on Bad Ink. A girl had down her neck. She thought it said balance or beauty or whatever, and it said, I'll be nice, nasty lady, bad lady. And they had a Chinese woman interpret what the girl had on her neck, and he did a cover-up. But it's funny, but it's not funny. So every time she walked into a Chinese restaurant, everybody probably died laughing. And that's really mean. But that's the same thing with this cartoon.
I had some people I knew who were Hawaiian, and they would talk about how they would sell cursed tikis to you know, mainland Americans. And, you know, again, they resented being part of the United States. And so people come over for touristy things, and they'd sell it to them, but they'd be cursed, or they'd be done not correctly in some way.
You know, there's in India and also in Egypt, there's karma. And if you do something rotten like that, at least in my traditions, you get that back three times, bad, awful, and worse. So that's really not a very nice thing to do. And I know it happened a lot. But, you know, I told the lady that maybe because her name was Annalise, that the guy just, you know, didn't understand what she said and wrote it that way. But she wasn't I'm going to say, as a customer, she wasn't a very nice person. And so I think maybe the vendor did it on purpose, like you're saying, as a way to say, screw you. You know, you're rotten beast. You can't read this anyway. But it's still pretty piss poor. But to go back,
and if karma is operational, it will get them back three times. But I know a lot of people who have reported such petty things happening to them or them having done to other people. So,
yeah, you get it back. You really do. On that note, let's talk about the feather of truth, which is a symbol drawn all over hieroglyphs, and it's balance. It's the goddess's name is Maat, Mayat, or Maat, and she's the mother of balance. And she works both in life and in death, so set the scales against you or in your favor. And many times you'll see in Egyptian tombs the heart, as I said, on the scales of justice and the feather of truth on the other side. So it really is important to make your heart be light, as the old Christmas carol says. You know, your eternity might depend on it. But I have since I'm aware of this, I have a good sense of humor, downright silly sometimes, but I try to make people laugh and lift their spirits and lift their heart to make them feel better. And I've made that a goal in my life, to remove and to live according to Maat, according to making things light, you know. So it just makes you feel better to laugh and smile and, you know, to live in Maat also means to live in truth, which means I would be very lousy in politics. You know, I'm not good at making promises I can't keep, and I'm not good at lying. You know, you have to be able to stretch things a little bit, and I'd rather not. My mom said something
the same way.
My mom said something a long time ago. You know, a lie is very, you know, you have to keep embellishing it to make it work. And the truth, if you just say it once, you don't have to forget. You don't forget what you've said. And it's just there in black and white. It's just real. And I find that better. I'd rather tell the truth. I'll say to somebody, and I own this, which means I'm going to own up to it.
Right.
The situation that my old job, somebody had broken something. And I knew who it was. And the person had quit. And I told the manager. And he said, well, why didn't you say something? I said, I'm saying it now. He just walked out the door after they pulled the handle off the refrigerator and broke it. And I said, I'm taking responsibility. I'm telling you how this happened. And there we go. But that's, you know, something like that. Or, you know, like George Washington, which is, I cannot tell a lie. Whether that's a true story or not, I don't know about the cherry tree. But I didn't live there in the 17th century, so I have no idea, 18th century. But, you know, I had many past lives. I don't think I was in Virginia that he was from?
I believe so.
I think he came from Virginia. But, you know, I cannot tell a lie. But we'll see. So, but that symbol, that feather, reminded people, wherever they went, to be open and honest and tell the truth and, you know, and speak and live according to balance in your life and live according to truth and to be real with people. It's a very important symbol, I think, more than people take it for granted, you know, and that scale was shown not only in temples and tombs, but in schools. The Egyptian Per Ankh, which is the school of life, says, you know, live according to Mat. And they reminded people constantly to do that. And I like that. I do. Another symbol that was important too, you'll see everywhere, is a chalice. In many of the or a cup, they show that they think of life, the symbol of the Ankh, in one way, but also the offering cup to show that you're, you know, prosperity. There are two ways to show prosperity: loaves of bread, or and cups. My cup runneth over. My cup is full. My cup is empty. I'm starving or I'm successful. The cup was an important hieroglyph.
Yes.
And then you get into the names of the gods and goddesses, and that can be kind of complicated. You know, you've got all this stuff going on, the names and the letters and what have you. As I said before, the pictograph, in that respect, was more important. All of the gods and goddesses have hieroglyphic names written. It gets confusing when you talk about Isis and Hathor, because Isis wears steps on her head, but sometimes she wears a disc with bullhorns, and Hathor almost always wears a disc with bullhorns. And so there have been debates back and forth when you look at different pictures and tombs of which goddess is which. And then you have to go look at the letters, the symbols, to see whether or not it's Isis or Hathor. If you're in the temple of Dendera, it's Hathor. If you're in Aswan or you're in the beautiful island of Philae, it's Isis. You can't make that mistake because it's their temples. But
right.
The ordinary person walking into a room and looking at that, many times I've heard a lady or a gentleman say, oh, that's Isis, or oh, that's Hathor, and it's not. And because I've learned my lesson a long time ago, I will not chime in anymore. You get into arguments with people, and, you know, they all know much more than you do. So I don't interfere anymore. I won't say, no, you're wrong. It causes trouble. And I backed away. I think it's wise. Maybe as you get older.
I think so, too. And I think it is getting older because, there are so many interpretations, even in antiquity, that I just look at it as a different interpretation. And my relationship with Olympus and with the powers is different than other people's. But all relationships, people have all sorts of different relationships with each other, and they can be very different. So I've just learned to accept it, and I don't argue either. I might see things differently, and then it's up to the person to change my mind or not. But that's all my decision. And so I'm willing to listen. I'm willing to share my perspective, but I'm not willing to argue about it anymore. It's not worth it, like to say.
I stopped years ago in a discussion group. It was exactly the incident I'm talking about. A woman went on and on and on about and corrected me. Isis was wearing the bullhorns, and it was in the tomb of Nefertari. And, you know, she went on and on. And I said, that's Isis, not Hathor. And she fought with me. She argued and argued and argued. I said, can you read hieroglyphs? And she said, I think so. I said, well, look beyond the image of the goddess. Above her shows her name, and it showed Isis. Now, the very fact that it's also to do with eternity, Isis' husband is Osiris. He's the Lord of eternity. And she, on one side was Isis, and on the other side was Osiris. It made sense. Why would it be Hathor, who actually is her daughter-in-law? You know, she's Horus's wife. Het Heru is her name in hieroglyphs, and it means the house of Horus. So why would she be there? If Osiris is there, certainly his wife, Isis, is going to be there. So the woman said, well, I didn't know. I said, but you spent 10 minutes arguing with me that I'm wrong, and the hieroglyph plainly says who it is. And then she said, well, you didn't have to argue with me. So I...
It's all your fault, Edna. It's your fault.
I'm wrong because you told me I was wrong. It's your fault because I knew I was right, but now you've told me I'm wrong, and I see that I'm wrong, but it's your fault. So
that's right.
I backed away.
Messing with people's realities like that.
Yeah, because, you know, she's one of these people. When I worked in retail, who would tell you she wore a size 7 shoe and she was a 9. You know, she'd squeeze in and she was going to buy that 7 shoe, even if it killed her feet. Same kind of person. So I just backed away. I was just like, okay, no. I can't talk to this person anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then she tried to private message me, and I blocked her. I had to. I knew that if I spoke to her, it would only be a fight, an argument. And I, you know, knowledge, age, and intelligence said, get away from that wacko. So I did. And I'm not, all I got out of it was a funny story, you know, and that's fine. I don't need that.
That's fine, yeah.
I'm looking again on my wall, and I'm looking at the 4 sons of Horus, who are Inset, Duabutef, Kevzenuf, and Hapi. And they're beautiful. It's like the sons of Hercules. I always equate Hercules and Horus. I do, because they're both warriors and they're both defenders of truth. Each one of these boys, these guys, are carrying a staff called a Was staff. And it's a very unusual staff. It's got a long body. It has a loop below it. And then there's an animal face on the front of it. And it's been long debated whether that is a jackal or an antelope or an anteater like Set. They don't know what that is. But it's an ancient symbol. And we talk about aliens. We talk about outside influences. But this staff, every single one of the gods and goddesses has this staff at one time or another. And it's a very powerful energy. It's a protection, but it's also a symbol of royalty or divine, a kingship, divine kingship and protection. And it's also showing that this being is not mortal. You'll never see a pharaoh carrying a Was staff. Only the king, only gods or goddesses will. And primarily gods. You don't see goddesses often carrying this either. But the head on the staff is a mysterious thing. To me, it looks like sort of a combination of a jackal or an anteater. It's got a very odd shape.
Mm-hmm.
Pointed ear and a downward face. But it's been shown since almost ancient primordial or pre-dynastic times. So this is a very powerful old staff. And there's also a combination staff that also has the backbone of Osiris, that animal head, and also an ankh, all combination. If you're my age or your age, Hercules, there was a group called the Sign, and they have that symbol in their video. I saw the Sign, and it opened up my eyes, and it's that symbol. And it's very interesting. I have an ankh that has that on there. It's called the combination charm, and it supposedly does protection, again, that warding off evil, and also wisdom, all in one one staff or one amulet. And it's very interesting that that's done that way. But this is something that's been around since the beginning of ancient Egyptian writing.
We are nearing the end of our conversation today, and since you're in the category of staffs, you make wonderful staffs, and thank you very much for the staff that you made for me. It was a message from the universe, and it was a very precise message, so I thank you for that, for all the time you put into it, for all the energy you put into it, and for communicating messages for me. I tend sometimes not to listen to the universe, so the universe has ways of repeating itself and making exclamation points. So your staff was a major exclamation point.
As soon as I started to work on it, it took shape on its own. And when I wanted to put something on top of it, and I didn't know what. And all of a sudden, that's not a natural cluster of crystals.
No.
I made that. The larger one in the center and the others around it. I found them, and they sort of glued themselves together. It just happened. And it said, when I finished the top of that staff, I knew who it belonged to. I called you. I said, this staff I made just now belongs to you. And you said to me, because a couple of weeks earlier, I had given you a large crystal point. And you said you saw that coming. But I knew that that staff and that crystal point and the other crystals you have would all work together to give you tremendous energy. When you wield that, it will send whatever is negative or wrong or bad. The message, it won't harm, but the message that you can't do this, you can't hurt the people around me, you can't do negative things, and that this is the light of Zeus, the light of the gods, and it's enlightenment. We're going to be in a situation soon where we're working in a path toward enlightenment, and that staff is a literal symbol of enlightenment.
Indeed it is, and I wish we had more time to talk about the staff. Maybe we'll devote an episode to it. But I'd love for people to be able to find you and to tap into all the wonderful things that you're doing. So how can people locate you and learn more about you?
The easiest way is Facebook. Michael K. Waterman at Facebook.com. You can get me on my phone number, 516-650-3691. You can get me at Makeup for You and More 53 on Instagram. You can get me also mkwaterman at icloud.com. And, of course, you can reach me through the auspices of the great Hercules Invictus.
Indeed you can. Thank you, my friend. I enjoyed learning from you today, and I'm enjoying our future sessions. Conversation. The robot just told me we have less than a minute. So thank you. I will speak with you very soon. And we have Atlantis to bring back. So I'm looking forward to that adventure as well.
Thank you, Hercules. Being a water man, I'm certainly Atlantean. Take care.
Awesome. And thanks to all our wonderful audience, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and you're patiently waiting in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Good night, everybody. And thanks again, Michael.